Yes, I am a Lutheran pastor, and I will come to what we want to talk about in a little bit. But let me start here, and I'm using the first lesson today. For the end of the first century, by then Christians were in great jeopardy. Domitian was the emperor of Rome, and he launched a great reign of terror against any person he thought would be a threat to his power. And guess what? It wasn't long before Christians became his target. After all, they refused to call him God. One of those Christians was a man named John. He was exiled to a small Greek island called Patmos. And there he wrote what is now the book of Revelation. He wrote it to encourage other Christians to be faithful to God. Now hear this. He wrote that document primarily for seven churches that he knew. They were scattered throughout the country that we now know as Turkey. Some modern Christians think that Revelation was written for them, and that it tells events for our future. It wasn't. The very first of the book, the first verse of the book, says the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. Now, we will admit that many times today we try to read it, and we get confused. There's a lot of theologians believe that's the way it's supposed to have been. They believe that he wrote it in a kind of a code to these seven churches. Why? Because if the Romans ever got that book, saw that it was going to these seven churches, and could understand what it was trying to tell them, they would be persecuted as well. So, using John's words to predict our future was never John's intent. On the other hand, there are several messages in this book that are good for us to hear. Three of them. Number one, remain faithful to Christ. Number two, live Christ-like lives. And number three, withstand any persecution, even if it means great suffering and death. Being faithful even to death, and you receive the crown of eternal life, which is what we know as the glorious victory for us. Now, why are we concerned about these seven churches? Well, first of all, they don't exist anymore. We believe probably the Roman soldiers destroyed all of them. Anyway, why important? Our ancient brothers and sisters in Christ once gathered regularly at each of these seven sites. Paul probably preached at most of those sites. There they were baptized and married, and some of them there were buried from there. There they worshiped, celebrated Holy Communion, fellowshiped together, ate together, served together, laughed together, cried together, and even suffered and died together. Now, one of these elderly men was named Polycarp. He was a respected leader of the church in Smyrna. That was one of the seven churches. Now, if there ever was a saint, a faithful Christian, it was Polycarp. Along the way, he was asked by the Roman authorities to renounce Christ, and they would save his life. Hear his answer. 86 years have I served Christ, and in nothing has he wronged me. How then can I blaspheme my king who saved me? That was his answer. So the Romans made a bonfire, placed the godly old fellow in the middle of that fire, and burned him to death. Within days, 12 other of these people from that same church suffered that same end. They would not renounce Christ and call Caesar their Lord. They heard John's message, "Stay faithful to Christ even in difficult times." Well, I quickly have to leave that, but I wanted you to understand Revelation maybe a little better. At the very end of this passage is what I want to talk about. It was just read. The one who is seated on the throne will shelter them. They will hunger no more, they will thirst no more, for the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd, and he will guide them to springs of the water of life. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Christian faithfulness includes serving those in need, especially in the early church, and certainly us today. Giving a cup of cold water to the thirsty, food to the hungry, support to those in need, shelter to the homeless. Your congregation has heard these words, and I've learned that in many ways you're supporting that kind of thing. Now let me tell you about another part of the world that is in desperate need. Haiti is an extremely poor country. In fact, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. It is one of 17 countries where poverty is extreme in the Caribbean, where food for the poor works. I've spent a significant amount of time in Haiti over the last 25 years and would like to share with you what I have seen and how food for the poor has been bringing this cup of cold water to these very, very poor. Very first time is about 23 years ago. The head of Food for the Poor took 10 of us pastors to Haiti so we could see ourselves. I'm not going to tell you the whole story, but I'm going to pick out several things that really have stuck with me all these years. We went to a place called Cité Soleil. In Haitian, that means City of the Sun. It's like all of us going to Florida, isn't it? Well, actually, it's a garbage dump. It's the biggest garbage dump you've ever seen. It's the garbage dump for Port-au-Prince, the capital city. And what amazed me even more than that, there were 1,000 families living among those garbage piles. That's the only place they had. And they didn't live in, I wouldn't call them shacks. There were pieces of tin with cardboard and some pieces of material that they had gathered from those piles. They somehow kept them together, and under them would they be for the family of 5 or 6. The closest well was 5 miles away. So picture this. One person from that family had to travel 5 miles with a little plastic bucket, get the water, bring it back 5 miles, and that was the water for that family for that day. Then we went to another place. It was a little concrete building, very little paint. We knocked on the door, and a Roman Catholic nun came to the door and welcomed us. It was a home for lepers. I didn't know leprosy existed. I thought that had gone out with biblical times, but there it was. Today, both of those places have wells very close to them, thanks to Food for the Poor. Now, about 18 years ago, several of us pastors in South Florida, Lutheran pastors, had decided we were going to go and start a home, a school for children of all ages. We went there to find the spot, and we ended up with a place called Gontier, Haiti. It's a little town of almost 300 people. They were celebrating, as only a very poor little community could do, and we wanted to know why. Well, the answer was, that week, one of the five-year-old girls had graduated from kindergarten. That was the first person in that whole village that had any formal education at all. Now, when the school was being built some years later, I took 15 people from my congregation, Christ Lutheran Church in Cape Coral, with me. We were going to help build the place. One of the ladies who loved to entertain kids in classrooms took crayons and coloring books and a clown suit that she was going to entertain them with. When we got there and gave them the crayons, they had never seen one before. They had no idea what a coloring book was. And when she put on the clown suit, they ran away because they thought she was a demon. Years later, the school was completed. It provides 16 years of education for each child. They begin at 3 years old and go all the way to 13th grade. It's a wonderful school. They learn four languages. We don't have time to talk about all they do. Every time there's registration, they can receive 40 children. When the parents learn that registration is coming, 2,000 families line up hoping to get those 40 positions. In Haiti, there's very little health care. If you break something, if you lose teeth, if you get sick, however you treat yourself, that's how you're going to be for the rest of your life. 2 years ago, again, us five pastors and now some others, along with Food for the Poor, built a new health clinic. Haiti is the poorest nation in the world. We also went to Honduras, a very poor section, and there I saw for the first time tilapia ponds. You know what tilapia is, a fish that we eat. Five ponds, fingerlings put each month in succeeding pools. By the sixth month, you went back, and the fish had grown large enough so they fed these people. Talking about fishing, you know, in these island nations, there are a lot of coastlines. There are a lot of fishing villages. You tell me, if you were this poor, how would you catch fish? Don't tell me you'd have a boat. They would not have a boat. Don't tell me they would have nets. They couldn't afford them. Don't tell me they'd have tackle. They couldn't afford them. So likely, you know, I don't know how all of them did it, but likely the man of the house would go wading into the water up to here. And he'd wait for the fish to swim by, and he'd catch them. Have you ever tried to do that? Yeah, a lot of them you miss. And that's what happened. In most of these cases, the man would come back with five fish or four, about that long, to feed his family of five. It's interesting, when they got the fish, they just swallowed the whole thing. They didn't gut it. There wasn't anything to gut. Food for the Poor is now providing fishing packages, one for each village. The package was a boat with a motor, not a big fancy one, but a little bigger than the rowboat, so they could go into the water about 300 feet. Because there we have discovered there's nice fish. I've got a picture of some of them out there. And now they catch fish, they come back with buckets of fish. And they can feed their family. They can feed their neighbors who are very poor. They can train some of the other neighbors to use this boat and the package. They can sell some of the fish, and they're becoming self-sufficient. One more thing about Port-au-Prince that surprised me. Lots of people still are in food lines. They have big vats of rice that are cooking. They put sardine sauce on it. It's not very good, but it kind of is good for their nutrition. And a big ladle, they would come and plop rice into their bucket, and that's for that family to eat for the day. That line was over 1,000 long. It took all day to feed them. Two other things that I wanted to tell you about. This is not something I saw. This is something I heard about Food for the Poor. Last Easter, they shared with us that they paid the fines of about 200 prisoners. I wondered why. Well, let me tell you the story of Kenneth. That's not his real name. His parents had died. He had three siblings, and he now became the person in the house that had to try to feed them. Had no money. So he stole a gold chain. He's going to sell it so that he could use the money to feed his family. Well, he got caught and got put in prison. It was that kind of person. Food for the poor, paid the fine so those people could get out and begin feeding their families. Finally, we also heard again that about that same time, in early March, as they were scouting the area, they found in the lower part of Haiti, the south part of, there's huge mountains. They found 240 people holed up there for 6 months. 6 months earlier, that is a Category 4 hurricane named Matthew. They fled to there, and for 6 months they lived in the cave. Food for the Poor has been building houses, has fed them food, blankets, hygiene kits, kerosene stove, tarps, and so on. I think you've gotten enough of the picture of Haiti and those other countries. Now, I want to quickly tell you something about Food for the Poor. It's 35 years old. It's the largest, second largest faith-based international agency in the world. It works in the 17 Caribbean countries among the very, very poor that I've been describing to you. Food for the Poor was begun by a man named Ferdinand Mifood. He's a wealthy Jamaican. He was so depressed that he was about to take his own life. I heard these words from him. He said, "I had all I needed to live on, but nothing to live for." His wife was very concerned about him, so she got the book by Catherine Marshall. I think some of you know about Catherine Marshall. Slipped it into his briefcase, not to his knowledge, as he was going to boarding a plane for another one of his business trips. He read the book, his life changed, and Food for the Poor was born. Food for the Poor is not funded by the government. It depends on people of faith to fund its work. Lutherans, Methodists, Roman Catholics, Episcopalians, most of the Food for the Poor resources come from people like us. It provides $1.5 billion of aid each year. The exciting thing for me is its operating expenses last year and practically every year before that is 4.4%. That means 95.5% of every dollar you give goes directly to the poor. In 2016, 617 million meals fed malnourished children and their families. Since 1982, Food for the Poor has built over 118,000 houses. Now, it's not a house like yours or mine. It's 12 foot by 15 feet. So that isn't a house. Well, if you've never had a house before, if you've lived like most of these, it's a palace. And it changes the life of that family. Last year alone, 686 tractor trailer loads of medicine and supplies were sent to these places. Why am I here? We badly need your help. We need your prayers. We need your offerings. Remember, there is no government money. Remember, almost all the major Christian denominations are part of this program. Food for the Poor digs wells, builds houses, creates health clinics, provides food. It also assists church bodies who want to start a mission project like this. And if there's any people in here who want to start a project out of this facility, I'd be happy to talk to you about it. We have, and you have it in your, right, if I can get it out of here, one of these. It opens up, you have it in your bulletin, and it tells you some of the story that I've been telling you. And guess what? On the end of it, this comes off. It's a self-addressed, postage-paid envelope. We hope that you will help us out. There are some of you who might be willing to give it today and send it with me, and then we can prevent the cost of their mailing costs that they, of course, would pay. I've got to quickly end. This is a story by another speaker. Happened 6 years ago in the O'Hare Airport. Many of us stay there while we're going out to our congregation. This older lady, the speaker was sitting there reading his book, waiting for the plane. This older lady said, "Today's the day." He ignored her, kept reading. She got closer and said, "Today's the day." He looked up, he said, "What's today?" And she explained to him that she saved her money all year long, and once a year she would go to Manhattan to have a fabulous feast. And then she said, "Today's the day." She held up three $100 bills. They talked for a while, and she said, "And what do you do?" And he began explaining to her what I've been telling you. As they parted, she handed him a $100 bill, and he protested. He said, you've been saving all year for your fabulous feast. And she said in response, "That's all right, I can make it on what's left. But for the first time in many, many years, I won't be eating alone. There will be 3,000 children dining with me."